Sometimes you gotta think like a lady.
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 And act like a boss.
Welcome to Think Like a Lady. You can follow us on Twitter at @ThinkLikeALady_ or on Facebook at @ThinkLikeALadyPodcast, as well as on Instagram at @ThinkLikeALady_podcast. We're available to listen to on all the major podcasting platforms, including Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or just ask Amazon Alexa.
Welcome back to Think Like a Lady. Last episode, we talked about sex on a woman's terms in terms of marriage in Islam and how women deal with it both on Western standards and Eastern standards and how it's kind of a struggle either way. This episode, we're going to talk about an outsider's perspective on female issues in Islam, as well as just like the general perception that people who weren't part of this community thought. So, you know, for this episode, Dua couldn't be here today, but we have a special guest. Her name is Carly Deardorff. She's an international communication strategist with an emphasis in diversity in the media. Hi, Carly.
Hi there.
Dua and I, we were talking one day and we just thought to ourselves, you know, what must have children back in the day thought when 9/11 first happened? I might have been in like second or third grade. And I remember when I was in fourth grade, there was this kid named Dylan in my class and his dad was in the military. And I think his father was one of the like the first troops to be deployed to Iraq. And it was a super patriotic family. All of a sudden, I guess his family just decided they didn't like Muslims after that. And this kid, you know, he's just as young as I am, decided he didn't like me either. There was always jabs in, you know, my homeroom class. I also had math with him. He would always be like, what are you going to do? Are you going to blow up the school? Or like, or do your parents wear like a dot on your forehead? Which is funny because that's not even part of Islam, wearing the dot on the forehead. That's Hindu culture. Back then when he would make fun of me, no one seemed to like defend me either, because I felt like maybe the sentiment was the same across the board, because children that young don't understand. So, I mean, you were young back then too. What was your perception of us?
Yes. So I grew up in a very small town in Texas, secluded, very, I would say, close-minded in a lot of ways. And I was 6 years old when 9/11 happened. And so first grade, I believe. And the main thing I remember from the day was that I was supposed to go to my first concert. And that concert was a Christian concert. So I also grew up very much in First Christian Church and was very religious. And so when 9/11 happened, I remember being very confused and not understanding what was going on and why it was happening, and really just being afraid. And I think one of the biggest things that, you know, why it's important where I grew up is because I didn't have exposure to anyone who was Muslim. I didn't know anyone. I couldn't ask any questions. And I also studied international media with an emphasis on minority representation. That's what my master's degree is in. I have done a lot of study and research into the way that the media can frame enemies and the good versus the bad. And I think this was a big period of time when we were really young. Of course, we had no idea what was happening. And added to not knowing what was going on, I also had no exposure to anyone who may have been impacted by this. There was no one in my direct community.
Right. So, I mean, what did you think of Muslims in general? Did you just see them as foreigners, people far away? I mean, we're less than 1% of the U.S. population. So for someone who's not Muslim to run into another Muslim, the likability is pretty low.
Right. So when I was younger, I always had this fascination with things that were different. And one of my best friends, probably around third grade, she actually was Hindu. And I remember always being so curious about things. She had her nose pierced when we were really young. I remember one time she came home from a wedding, from a Hindu wedding, and she'd been gone for 2 weeks because she had gone back to India. And she was covered in the most beautiful henna tattoos I'd ever seen in my life. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, a completely different culture, but I did have some exposure to outside cultures, but I just didn't know anyone Muslim. So I think, especially when I was younger, I was just really curious, but also kind of confused. I didn't understand the hijab. I didn't understand really much of anything about Islam or about people, you know, Muslim people. And it was really one of those things that as I got older, I was always curious, but again, didn't have a lot of exposure. And I was in a small town in Texas and there weren't many people. And even once I moved to Austin, which is a bigger city, I still had no real interaction or real ability to have an open conversation with someone. And it wasn't until I was in my master's degree last year that I actually became very, very close friends with someone who is Muslim. And I was able to ask these questions and learn about the culture and, you know, a lot of the traditions and just things that I'd always wondered about. To keep in perspective as well, like, I had a lot of friends growing up who were Mexican. I had a lot of friends, you know, from different cultures. I had a friend who was from Taiwan, and I always loved that. Like, I always loved learning more, but I just didn't have the ability to do that with anyone who was Muslim back home.
Right, because how could you? If you don't have the exposure, you just don't. But I'm glad, you know, as a child, you decided to remain confused rather definitively deciding that maybe I should dislike these people.
Right, and I want to add there too that there was no question that that was around me. So my personal, especially as a child, thoughts were very different than what I was surrounded by. And so the person you described, you know, that you interacted with as a child, there were definitely those people around me and still sometimes are people like that around me who have this very unjustified hate for Muslim people, who don't understand that Islam is such a huge religion around the world and that what their idea is in their mind of someone who is Muslim is sometimes so off and so very different than the reality. That hatred and that fear really is what I think it stems from, is very much present and was very much present around me growing up. You know, in the Bush era, there was a lot of that around me and my family, and I didn't understand it. But this is something that I've thought about multiple times, especially as a child when I heard Arabic being spoken, I would get afraid. I would have this like sense that something was wrong or something was bad. It was something that I couldn't explain why or understand, but I knew that I was afraid. I have a younger brother, and it was actually this past Christmas, and we were living in an apartment for an amount of time, and he was coming upstairs at the apartment, and there were two men who were speaking Arabic to one another. And I saw him get scared. I'm getting chills right now thinking about it, because when it happened, I like went back up to him and I said, "Connor, did you hear those, you know, those two men having a conversation?" He said, "Yeah, I didn't understand." I was like, "Yes, it's because they're speaking a different language. But I also want you to know that there's nothing wrong with that, that it's a different language. And sometimes it's scary when you don't understand people, but that that doesn't mean that what they're doing or saying is bad or wrong." And so it was just a really big teaching moment that I wish someone would have said to me when I was little, because I do remember that fear based off of nothing really, other than what I'd seen on movies or on the television or on the news.
Right. And you mentioned movies, because a lot of the times it's so subliminal. People who would say, "I'm not racist," but then they have like a very subconscious subliminal reaction of like maybe being scared of language. I still don't think that makes them racist. To be racist, you have to be actively impeding on the livelihood of somebody else. But that reaction is visceral in a way, I think, because of these small, tiny messages that you learn as a kid. So I remember like all the movies, right before something blows up, right, they say Allahu Akbar, which in, you know, Arabic, that means God is great. But in Hollywood, they've kind of perverted the term to be something as violent. I remember I had an American friend who told me he went to a couple of Arab countries and he kept on hearing that word left and right. And he was like, "It's so commonly used there. And if I ever heard it in America, I'd be scared for my life." And I said, "Really? Like, that's your reaction?" He was like, "Yeah, because in the movies, right, that's what they always say. Like, that's right, what the terrorist is saying." And I was like, "That's funny, because in the Middle East, that's like a term of endearment." And he was like, "Huh, I wonder like why I reacted that way." I was like, "You know why? It's because people who weren't Muslim told you to be afraid of that term."
Exactly. And when you have no other exposure and all you see is what the media has portrayed, and when the media is not doing a good job of diversifying any of those stories. In my master's, we had one course specifically, and one of the things we talked about was the 4B stereotype with Islam and with Muslims. And the 4Bs are bomber, burqa, billionaire, and belly dancer. These 4 stereotypes are we see played over and over and over in the media, whether that's films, think of Aladdin, Zero Dark Thirty, and the ones that you discussed that, you know, are centered around the war. You think of a very, very limited perspective of a group of people that is immense and that is huge, and that there's such a small percentage in our country. I think in terms of media framing, whether it's the news, films, or music, I mean, there just was such limited exposure. And so if you're only seeing one side, and also you're very young, it's something you don't understand. It's something your family doesn't understand. And then every source of information that they're looking has very much vilified and villainized a whole group of people. And, you know, this is also during the time of Al-Qaeda and all of these things that Americans were very, very, very afraid of. And we discuss also when the Berlin Wall fell, that was kind of this really great moment of losing this enemy of communism and progress in that direction. And the media needed a new enemy. It needed a new threat. And the timing of it is really just disheartening because there needed to be a good and bad. And that is what framing came around it. Those were the stories that got picked up. Those were the stories that people were listening to. Those were the stories people were paying attention to. And those were the things that educated a whole country, at the very least just in the US, but our US media goes very, very far in this world. And I don't know, I think from a media perspective, it's just really disheartening. And also it does a disservice to so many people. And it's frustrating.
It's definitely frustrating. It's funny because you bring up Aladdin and it's always very subliminal. You never notice the smallest things. But if you notice, even in the movie Aladdin, the bad guys, they have an Arab accent and the good guys have an American accent.
Yep.
Isn't that interesting? You bring up the Middle East and, you know, the Middle East gets a bad rap. Like, you know, why is that region always in turmoil? A lot of people don't realize Arabs by themselves did not decide that that region would be in turmoil all the time. It's actually because of the West that that area is in turmoil. Pretty much every part of the world that's been touched by imperialism and colonization, be it by Britain or the United States, it's the reason for their turmoil. So for example, you know, when Pakistan and India were divided, that was divided by a British guy, that border during the partition in 1947. And that's kind of what led to so much bloodshed back then. Or like the scramble for Africa, when all these European countries decided we're going to divide up this entire continent for their resources, that threw the entire region into chaos. And so like when all these European countries decided to leave after exploiting the entire continent, you saw that the entire continent was thrown into turmoil because you had tribes pitted against one another when the West decided, let us draw the borders, not the people living there.
Right.
So same thing with the Middle East. When the Ottoman Empire fell right after World War I, these countries were being born, right? Syria, Lebanon, Palestine was on the brink of it. And these Western countries, including the United States and Britain, they decided they were going to draw the borders. They were going to intervene and draw the borders and throw the entire region into chaos. And it's been chaotic ever since. And they usually do this because they have an interest in drawing these borders. They want, you know, whatever part of the land that has oil, they want their buddy to own that part of the land. So, you know, they're going to want Saudi Arabia, their friend, to own where all the oil reserves are. So let's draw the borders according to that way, whatever special interests are there. But I kind of want to shift the conversation in terms of specifically Muslim women's issues. When it comes to several women's issues in terms of Islam, the West in general does not understand it. There's a difference between tolerance and acceptance. And then between tolerance and acceptance, there's understanding. And so generally, even though times have gotten a little bit better, but not recently in terms of the last election, I believe there is not a general understanding of why women in Islam dress the way that they do. There's a general misconception of parsing out culture with religion. What's your perspective on that? Like, as someone who's pretty much been on the outside, how are you able to interpret all of this?
In terms of interpreting it, I think I do my best to learn from people who experience it. From your podcast, y'all's podcast, I've learned so many things, and really by asking questions and trying to understand. obviously, I haven't always been able to ask those questions or find this type of media source to really understand that other perspective. Obviously, in the last 10 years, we've seen these things really be able to explode so we can see and hear these different perspectives. As a young child, like I told you before, I didn't understand the burqa. I didn't understand a hijab. I didn't understand why. But I always remember thinking, it's so pretty. Like, the cloth is so pretty. And, you know, it may sound silly, but as a little kid, I just remember kind of being in awe in a strange way, but also feeling this like almost, and this is going to sound very Western, and it is that how you want to be? Like, does that feel good to you? Do you feel, is some man controlling you? Because I also grew up with a single mother. Because of my experiences, because of our life, I was kind of man-hating. And I saw a lot of control of men in the society around me, in the culture that surrounded me, whether that was in Christianity or just within my direct relationship. Relationships. And it was really hard for me to separate and distinguish, and always has been, religion from control, and there being, you know, some man in the sky controlling what I do or what I say. I always had a really difficult time swallowing that. So as that has to do with Muslim women, you know, I definitely thought, is some man telling them they have to do this and they can't show themselves, or they can't, you know, throw on a tank top and go down the street? I never knew those answers. And honestly, I still don't know those answers. And so please tell me some of them and, you know, like help me learn, because I think that's the whole point of this, right? Like, not only for me, but for anyone listening who is scared to ask these questions, right?
For sure. I mean, just for our listeners out there, if you want people around you to learn more about your faith, you have to have an open and accepting space. And so that's a good question. I can understand for a lot of Westerners, they can't wrap their mind around it. They're like, why would you want to wear that? You know, because to them, I think there's this established ideology in the West that the more covered you are, the less rights you have, I guess, or the less freedom you have, right? Because they see, you know, the amount of clothing you wear as some type of constriction. And so in reality, there's freedom in just choice in general, right? There's the choice to wear as much as you want and as little as you want. That's the definition of freedom to me. But to a lot of people, they just couldn't fathom that. They would look at a woman in a burqa or look at a woman in a hijab and just think to themselves, like, why would you put yourself up for that? For the sake of people in the West to understand this, they have a pretty good grasp on yoga and like meditating and being really in touch with your soul. It's similar to that and being very in touch with your spirituality, kind of like a monk. You would want to do that because that's what you believe in, and you believe in it that much that you want to do that. For someone who doesn't understand that type of spiritual level or that type of spiritual realm, they feel just very confused by it, I guess. I don't know if that's like the best explanation as to why someone would want to do that from the perspective of somebody who's not part of this religion, but I think that's the best explanation I can give.
Well, that I think that's like a really great way to think about it in terms of not understanding and not being devoted to something that much. And it's also something that I admire. And even from my Western perspective, right, as a sacrifice, it may not feel that way. And it probably doesn't feel that way if it's just been a decision that either you've known you would make or you make at a point. And then another thing that comes up in my mind is like, at what age do young women make that choice? And what does that look like?
Right. I mean, you've heard our previous episodes where we kind of have conflict within the own community, right?
Right, right.
Just as any community does. We're no different from the West. We have objections here in the West within our own communities, right? So does the Muslim community.
Right.
I object that women shouldn't start too young. It should be an independent and autonomous decision on their own. Some people don't live life that way and they would want their kids to start at a very early age.
Like how early? 7, 8?
I've known people to start their, you know, children at 7, 8. I've known them to start them at like 13, 14. Some start in their late 20s. Some women have started in their 40s and 50s. It just varies. The reason I've mentioned this on a previous podcast that I object to girls starting at an early age is that they kind of don't know what they're signing up for. You kind of have to be devoted to this for you to want to do it. And so you can't expect that type of devotion out of a child.
Or understanding. That's been always something that's been, because if I was told to do something when I was 8 years old and then just had to do it all the time, I can only imagine that by the time I was in my 20s or something, and it's different because I don't have that connection to the spirituality. But if it was me, I feel like I would have gotten defiant or whatever, and at a point just been like, I'm not going to do what you tell me to do anymore. I think that's a Western perspective.
And you know, some people do. They do get defiant because it was kind of pressured upon them. Others don't. They end up embracing it and they end up liking it. And for me, it's just like, you know, why gamble with what a child wants? Just wait until they're older and let them make that autonomous decision. That's with anything, right? That's not just with hijab. Like, you take Islam out of it. You know, you wouldn't want to put your child on a vegetarian diet for ethical reasons that you don't want to kill animals. Your child's not going to understand or practice yoga and meditating, but they don't understand why they're doing it. This goes for anything in life in general. If there's something that you're enforcing upon your child that requires a depth of spirituality to it, the child's not going to understand it because the idea is too complex to comprehend at that age. That just goes across the board. It's not just something that's unique to hijab. In Islam, there's something called iman, which is a level of devotion that you have. And there was an episode where we talked about how the level of devotion is not parallel with wearing hijab, but rather women who decide to wear it, it's a type of spirituality in its own compartment, if that makes sense. If we were to like compartmentalize spirituality in several boxes, there are certain things that you may pick up and you'll be really devoted to do. Pray your all 5 daily prayers, but you're lacking in this one thing that you feel like you're just not ready for yet, but you know that you're very, very devoted to God. You're going to do the one thing that you've decided to do. You know, it's not like math. It's not like 1 + 1 = 2. It's very abstract, and feelings are very abstract. These things, I feel like people who are not part of the religion tend to have a hard time grasping, if that makes sense.
No, it entirely does, especially someone who may not be directly spiritual or devout in their own right? Like I would say myself, it's like another realm, and it's another, I like how you've described it, like as another dimension, because there is something that is more and that is bigger, and that relationship is something that I think a lot of Westerners have a hard time grasping. Even those who have grown up Christian or continue to be all of those things, like I still think I did, like I told you, I did grow up very much in the Christian church and I was baptized. You know, I still go on holidays and stuff with my grandmother. And I think that there is a lack of that connection and there's a lack of that depth, if that makes sense, in the way that I have experienced religion that I could never imagine. Again, we all see it through our own lens, right? Like I could never imagine being that devoted to something. And there is something to do with, you know, the man in the sky thing. And it's about the man that makes it so hard for me. And that's in itself something that is in my history. And
right.
I don't want to say a wound, but a scar maybe, right? Like something that has impacted how I see religion, how I see the world, how I see relationships, and put up a block where it may not need to be. Mm-hmm. But I think religion and spirituality are so foundational in so many people's lives. And it's such an important thing. And it's also something that I look at, again, in admiration, because to be that devoted and that, and again, like not showing everything. We could talk about all day long how revealing or sometimes horrifying we have women's bodies in, you know, Western media, Western cultures, and that being able to not wear a top or whatever is freeing. In the context, I would say really, especially in Europe, but is that free to every woman? And is that what feels good and right to every woman? No. Who are we to get to decide what freedom looks like for someone? And I think there is this notion, the less you need to do for a male gaze, the better. And like the less you can think about it or worry about it. But is it even about the male gaze? You know, for Muslims.
Yeah, right. That's a great insight. A lot of people do misconstrue that and think it has somehow to do with the male gaze. And in fact, people within their own Islamic world have made that argument. But there have been numerous times where it's been pointed out, where does it say anywhere in the scripture that the sake of us covering has anything to do with the male gaze? But more so, it has to do with us kind of taking control of our own sexuality in a way. There's no winning, right? Like if we're out here wearing bikinis and stuff, we're told that we're doing it to get attention from men. And then if we're out here fully covered, we're being told that we're doing it to prevent men from looking at us. Like either way, why is it always about men?
Right. Amen. I think that's so true. I think that there's a very similar feeling there, right? Whether it's covering up too much or covering up too little, like I experience that, Western women experience that as well too, like in a very different way, but constantly is my skirt too short? Dress code in school, right? Like spaghetti straps, are they going to distract the boys? Are they going to be a problem? Why is it our responsibility to not distract them or to not, why is it not their responsibility to not have an opinion on what we look like?
Right, because there is no opinion when it comes to the attire of men, right? We're not out here thinking, oh, you know, the shorts are a little bit too short, or, you know, that that wife beater is a little bit too hollow.
Right.
You know, we're not out here thinking these thoughts. Oh, nor is it he's dressed fully from head to toe with, like, in loose clothing. What is he trying to prevent?
Right, or hide, or sneak in, or anything like that.
A woman's gaze is not a hot topic here, right? But somehow the male gaze is.
Right.
People can argue, and I guess there's scientifically truth to a certain extent, that men in general just have a higher sexual drive than women, and so it's harder for them to control themselves. On a social level, it's just like, get over it, you know?
Amen. Like, we have evolved so many things. Why is this something we still constantly
right with? If a woman's in a bikini, don't look at her, and if she's fully covered up, still don't look at her. It's just like, it's, that's right. The standard either way, right?
Just leave her alone.
That's just how I view it. That's really right. Interesting when it comes to like parsing out culture from religion, right? I can recall a great interview that I saw of Reza Aslan. He is a scholar, a historic scholar of religions, of all three Abrahamic religions. And he was on CNN one time. And I think the anchor, his name is Don Lemon. And he was asking him about several North African Muslim countries, their oppressive regimes. And then it was interesting because he was just like, what you're pointing out is culture and not religion. And they kept on associating the two together. And I was like, this is another problem we have. Westerners cannot distinguish the two. So I'll give you an example. FGM, which is female genital mutilation, is widely practiced in North Africa. We're talking about like Morocco, Egypt, Algeria. And a lot of people associate that with Islam. They think that this is part of the religion because these are predominantly Muslim countries. But no one has bothered to pick up a Quran. Right. There's not one mention of FGM. It's not a thing. It's completely non-existent. And that's interesting because when you go to other Muslim countries like, you know, Pakistan, or if you go to Lebanon or Syria, you won't ever hear anything of FGM. It just doesn't exist there. Other Muslim countries you have that don't practice this, and some do, and people aren't able to distinguish the two. Another example is like Saudi Arabia not allowing women to drive. Now I think they're allowed to drive. I remember I was watching The View at work on the TV. Meghan McCain, she was just like, well, you know, radical Islam, and that's why in Saudi Arabia women are not allowed to drive. And I was like, first of all, that's Saudi culture. We can all agree that culture is particularly patriarchal, one of the most, in my opinion. And I'm saying that as a Muslim. It's this inherent understanding that Muslim society is different from Islam. What the idea of religion is, and then the execution of it is Muslim society. And most countries have a poor execution of the idea. I just think people simply don't understand that, right? It's same thing with Christianity. You have this idea of Christianity, but, you know, the KKK is a very poor execution of Christianity. Would you not agree?
I would completely agree.
It's just that thing that people can't make that similar comparison.
I mean, all of these examples that you just offered are really, really great ways to frame, especially in a Western mind, that we are very, and I'm going to take it back to media because this is, you know, what the masses consume and, you know, what we all consume at some, to some extent.
Right.
Media framing is very, very powerful. One thing that the media loves is the good and the bad. And the black and the white and the red versus blue. I mean, it's these buckets, right? Of like, this is one way, this is that. I think that the Islamic world, Muslim cultures, all these things, they're very complex. And there isn't a direct connection between the world that the majority, whether it's the majority of readers or just the majority of the writers of these stories, understand or know how to really conceptualize or give enough context around. Mm-hmm. And then the reality is that that takes a lot of time. It takes a lot of time to learn these new complexities and these differences. And when you only hear one story a week about, you know, those people over in the Middle East, yeah, you just lump them all together, kind of like, oh yeah, those people in Africa, not thinking or imagining or understanding that Africa is this incredibly diverse continent in terms of culture, in terms of religion, in terms of language and experience and life and all of these things. And the same for the Middle East. I think one of the things that is so problematic in Western society, in American culture, is this reliance and this insistence on our experience, ourselves are the only thing that matter. Our country is the strongest in the world. We are better at all the things. This blind patriotism behind something and never poking holes in what the rest of the world looks like or what the rest of the world is learning or thinking or seeing or any of those details. And I think it comes down to, it's really hard to understand Muslim culture versus Islam to an everyday Western mind. It's just hard to grasp. It doesn't fall in line with economic trends and models or someone who goes to work every day and just doesn't either have the time or care to understand the complexities and the deepness that is there.
Right. And it's just about like making that simple effort, right? Like, I think that in and of itself makes a huge difference. This podcast is mainly about Muslim women's issues, but we're kind of expanding beyond that right now. Have you heard the term moderate Muslim?
I don't think so.
Oh, you haven't? No. That's funny. So every time like a terrorist attack would happen and stuff, I would always see on the news, where are the moderate Muslims? And I was just like, see, I don't like that term because you're assuming that that is the alternative and the default is that most Muslims are not moderate. Right. There's no such thing as a moderate Muslim. Most Muslims are pretty peaceful people. You have like a 0.001% perversion of it, just like every religion on earth. And I think people sometimes get shocked that Christianity is, in certain segments of the population, is just as perverted as Islam is, but it just doesn't get the same label. Yes. That's the difference, right?
Yes. And that ties back. And, you know, I want to make sure we stay around feminism and women's issues as well, but that ties back to the connection, right? Again, the framing. There's this cartoon that I'm actually looking at, and it's average press coverage of a terrorist attack. And on the left side, it is a man in a Klan uniform, you know, the KKK hat. And on the other side, it's, you know, a picture of a who knows from where, Middle Eastern man, you know, with a turban and a beard, and the difference in press coverage. And they are both terrorist attacks. But the way that things are framed and these white supremacists that are happening in this country today, that are going into schools and churches, that is not what is talked about. And that is not how it's framed. It's poor boy who he's mentally unstable. And that is how it's framed. And this is why I really urge like a call to the media, because they're framing these stories. They're framing what gets clicked, what gets paid attention to. But at the same rate, they are framing the way that the general population thinks about an entire group of people. And because the percentage of Muslim people is so low in this country, I think that's a huge part of the problem, because who is speaking on their behalf,
right?
And who is writing from their perspective? And that's why I love y'all's podcast, because you are speaking for yourselves. You don't need someone to do it for you. And it's really inspiring. And it's really the proliferation of media and being able to consume, understand, and learn from more voices than just those that, you know, work at the New York Times. I mean, I love a lot of the work they do, but at the same time, like, there just has to be more. Our country is so diverse, and that's the beauty, and those are the things we can learn from. And just, oh no, those poor women, like, they don't have any rights or freedoms. Like, it's bullshit.
Right. And, you know, kind of gearing this back towards women in general, even the West, if a woman is not wearing hijab, it's kind of also an insult to say that you're a little bit deviant from your religion because you're not wearing it, is kind of an insult. There's a good likelihood, you know, that maybe she's not deviant. Maybe she's actually very practicing. It's these nuances, right, that, you know, we'll understand within the Muslim community, but people outside of it haven't really taken the time to understand us, where, you know, they're not able to understand that maybe someone's just as devout. They just don't dress like it. It's just these complex nuances where I say all the time, like, you know, if you really want to understand us, maybe listen in on some of the family conversations that we're having. Then you'll understand we have conflict amongst ourselves. There's a segment of a population that believes that everyone should wear hijab. There's a segment of the population that believes that at the end of the day, it's a choice. You can't force it on anyone. Within Islam, there's like four schools of thought. There's like Hanafi, Maliki, like these are things the Western media and just the Western public in general hasn't taken the time to understand, which is funny because, you know, growing up in the West, in a country where there's supposed to be a separation of church and state, even as a child, I was taught very Christian ideals in school. It was very funny because I remember when I was a little girl and Christmas time would come around and all the festivities, I might have been in kindergarten. I was like, okay, cool. We're learning about Christian culture and, like, you know, what Christmas is all about. And then I was like, okay, then Eid is next up. And then I asked my teacher, okay, isn't, like, what are we going to do about Eid? And she's like, what are you talking about? I was like, Eid, you know, when Ramadan ends and, like, we all celebrate. And she's like, I have no idea what that is. It was like a huge utter point of disappointment. Wow. Right?
Yeah. And I think that is, it's such a disservice to our communities, right? To your community. If there is a student in your class, right? Like as that teacher, what an amazing opportunity to say, hey, can you tell me more about that? Can you explain to me? Can we talk about it in class? We can only hope for educators that will do that because I can only imagine the feeling that that would have. Because it's
for sure.
When I was in Spain and I was good friends, I mean, I still am good friends with my friend who is Muslim, I had like his first breakfast he did with me and our other friend. It was so amazing to like firsthand experience how he practiced like during Ramadan and like what he did. And we're in the middle of our master's like theses and we're, you know, doing all this stuff. And I just looked in admiration about the sacrifices and just like I learned so much. And without having that firsthand experience, I don't know how I would. So like you mentioned, like listen to our family conversations in terms of, you know, women's empowerment or, you know, whatever, like the conflicts we have within ourselves, that would be amazing if that was an option. How do we allow that to be more the case?
It's funny because it's like growing up in the U.S., like people don't understand the hijab. They haven't taken the time to learn femininity of Muslim women here. But I've been listening on a lot of Christian family conversations, right? I've been listening on like, you know, the divergence between Catholicism and evangelicals and how they're very different and they fundamentally disagree with each other on so many fronts. It's funny because even though I cannot say that I'm an expert on Christianity, I know more about Christianity than the average American will know about Muslims.
Yes, by far.
I get it. That's like the dominant religion here. We're 1% of the population here in the United States, but we're the second largest religion in the world. And what boggles my mind is the third largest religion in the world, which is Judaism, far behind Islam. It's not third by like a small margin. It's third by a large margin. There's a huge gap in the between second and third place. People here know a lot about Judaism. I'm thinking to myself, we're a quarter of the world population and you know close to nothing about us.
Right.
And so I thought that was just very interesting because, you know, growing up, they'll teach you about Judaism in textbooks. But then there's like almost no mention of this Islamic cultures and Ramadan and all these practices. But in terms of like hijab in general, I don't see like a visceral reaction in terms of like, you know, evangelical women who decide to dress conservatively. In fact, I remember when I was both in my master's and my undergrad, these evangelical people would come to try to convert people and they would say the most outrageous things. And I think the goal was to rile people up, but then you'll get one or two people who will come to your side and get interested. When they would do that, they said various things for shock value just to upset people. I remember the general public reacting to the evangelical woman who was on campus. They didn't see her as oppressed like they see Muslim women. They saw her as brainwashed. I was like, that's a very different reaction to some women. So you see a conservatively dressed evangelical woman and you perceive her as a very brainwashed person and just intolerant and, you know, and and you see her as someone like, you know, you can't understand that level of being devout,
right?
Which is something similar with wearing hijab. You can't see someone wanting to wear that. But the difference lies in is that you see some one person brainwashed and the other type of woman who wears hijab as oppressed.
I think there's something to be said as well about exactly that, like the oppressed versus the brainwashed. Why is it oppressed? Like, why is that our initial reaction? Is it because it's so visual? And it's something, I think it's because it's something that's so different than anything we understand. I saw something the other day about, you know, now everyone's wearing masks and just kind of the hypocrisy there, that now that everyone is wearing masks, no one is making any statement about being covered or, you know, there being a problem with that, about that being dangerous or anything like that. But when it comes to, you know, Muslim beliefs and being covered or your face being covered, that somehow that's dangerous or bad, or again, like controlled and oppressed. Those people, me included in the past, who maybe have thought like, oh, those poor women or any of those things, like, did they stop and ask them? Did they stop and say like, hey, is that how you feel? And this could go in any direction with females, right? Like with different offshoots of Christianity and Mormonism, or I think of like Mennonite culture or the Orthodox Jewish culture, like plenty of cultures where women are very, very conservatively dressed, right? And even, you know, in some of them wear bonnets or keep their hair very, very, very long. And I think at least I'm kind of putting this together right now, but maybe that's where in my mind, it's like control. Like there's a man controlling you and telling you, you have to do this. And that's always been the part that I like vehemently reject. But again, that's putting my own experience on some other woman who has a completely different experience in her life, right?
Right. That could have been completely their own choice. We don't know what goes on inside their heads, right? So it's just same thing for us. I think is what people have a hard time grasping.
Right.
But I think the difference is just there's in the West where Christianity is a much better understood religion in general and all the different denominations of it. The reaction that I've seen in terms of women, if a Christian woman is conservatively dressed to whatever degree, they don't see her as oppressed. And then in terms of Muslim women, a religion that's a lot less understood here in the West, they just see that as completely oppressed. Because, I mean, let's face it, the impression that Westerners have is that Islam is a very patriarchal religion. There's a good segment of the population, of the Muslim population, that sees the West as very patriarchal, right? Because the bottom line is patriarchy manifests itself across all borders. Doesn't matter what religion.
Yep, all religions, all cultures.
Right. Yeah. It just manifests itself with different faces, right? That's just how it pops up. Mm-hmm. But they feel like Muslim women are being controlled by men or whatever. That's how they see it here in the West. But, you know, Muslim women, they look at the West and they say, well, how come you guys have to change your last name when you get married?
Right.
That's mind-boggling to them. Because in Islam, a woman doesn't change her last name when she gets married. She carries on the lineage. Mm-hmm. With like she keeps her own last name. Islam being the first religion to give women property rights. In terms of Orthodox Christianity, there's not really any mention of that. So like that's the perception you'll get on the Muslim side. It's funny because both East and the West are looking at each other thinking that society is more patriarchal than the one that I'm in.
Right.
When really they're both wrong.
Right. Right. So. Really, these systems are dominant and they, you know, infiltrate everything, right? Like, again, the whole reason that we even discuss what we as women wear in any religion or in any culture is, again, because of a paternalistic structure that very much feeds off of women's physical image and, you know, the way that they represent themselves, the way that they dress, the way they do their hair or their makeup or any of those things, right? And it's crazy. I mean, it is so, as we continue to make strides and, you know, learn things and grow and become more educated and do all of these things, to see the systems very much just ingrained with this thought process throughout everything, from our education systems to our jobs, you know, to our churches even. Like, what space can a woman just be what she is and not have to be worried or afraid? And I think, you know, y'all touched on that on a few different episodes, and that really, is it just around one another? Is it just around women? But then we have this one versus the other, not understanding each other. And so would we feel comfortable to just have these conversations at a societal level, right? Like if all the women could just get together, like, could we talk about these things? Like, I don't know. Is there too much judgment about, oh no, you're controlled by your husband. Oh no, you're controlled by your husband. Yeah, you both are. Or maybe you're both not. We just need to have that conversation in the middle. Just like this, I guess, you know?
Right, for sure. Because you and I, we're two extremely different people. Right. Like, you know, I'm someone of faith and I believe in an Abrahamic religion. I think from what I remember, you told me that you're not. Right. And, you know, you grew up here in the West with very minimal exposure. And I grew up kind of in with my foot both in Western culture and Islamic culture. And, you know, a third foot in Pakistani culture.
Right.
It's very different. But, you know, going back to, you know, the viewpoint of the West and their vantage point of a Muslim society overseas, it's interesting because the conservatives here in America, I mean, this is how I feel. Liberals do it too. Don't get me wrong. Conservatives just bluntly say things,
right,
and liberals will kind of just like be careful with their words.
Right.
But the conservatives here in this country, well, they blatantly profess their beliefs that they see Islam as a very, you know, oppressive religion. And, you know, they're the ones who peddled this idea openly of separation of church and state. And that's why they were all for the Arab Spring and let's go in and all these Middle Eastern countries and topple all these dictatorships to establish a democracy, like in Libya. You know, Syria is still at war till this day, Egypt. That's funny because these are the same people who are invading other countries, peddling this idea of separation of church and state and trying to establish a democracy. But yet you use religion to justify overturning Roe v. Wade here in the United States. Right. Isn't that very interesting?
Yes, there is an immense hypocrisy, especially in, you know, the foreign affairs and how things are done, and also how they're framed and how they're taught to us, our, mm-hmm, the population under. I think I'm in this book club that meets once a week about being a better ally. We had this discussion a couple weeks ago about blind patriotism, which I think I said earlier too. This blind patriotism and this notion that
American exceptionalism,
all for one for all, exactly, American exceptionalism, and that we are the best and we are the most powerful and we are the strongest and we are so lucky and our freedoms, all of those things, which to an extent are true. And to an extent, like, I am very thankful that I have an American passport. I am very thankful, you know, to, mm-hmm, be where I'm from. And at the same time, never poking holes or looking at the atrocities that have occurred by our doing, and by our, I mean, you know, the US, not personally me. And even being able to admit when there were faults or when there were things that were wrong. And obviously we're very much seeing the wake of that right now. Like, we have such a problematic, troubled history in this country. And then it's just spun as in, oh, well, you know, it's already so destabilized over there, so we're just going to go fix it. No, that's not what's happening. That's not what's going on. But when the only messaging gets to come from that perspective, then of course everyone's just going to buy it up. We're the good ones. Like, we can't be the bad ones. It's got to be those, you know, people in the car bombs. Like, no. Again, it's a very oversimplified narrative of
you
the
know,
reality.
That's interesting you say that. There's two things I want to say. Number one thing is, I remember I was watching this interview of this female CIA agent, and she kind of had her voice kind of altered so no one would recognize her. And she's been in interrogation rooms with the, mm-hmm, Taliban. And she said, you have to understand, is that in our eyes, they're the villains. But in their own eyes, they think they're the heroes. They genuinely believe that, right, what they're doing is the right thing to do. They genuinely, genuinely believe that they're the good guys. I was like, that's interesting because, right, we see ourselves that way too. We genuinely believe that we're the good guys. Someone who hates the Taliban for what they've done, a lot of grievances towards the United States of what they've done to, you know, the Muslim world in general, as many do. It's not just Muslims that have grievances, just pretty much the entire world has grievances for this. This idea of you always sticking to the idea that you're the good guy is what kind of sends you down the rabbit hole and trying to justify this notion of, oh, well, it was a necessary evil.
Yes.
I mean, that's how I view it for sure. We're the country that kind of peddles this idea of separation of church and state. Yet in all the Western democracies, we're probably top on the list of the democracies or so-called democracies that have more institutionalized religion than we care to admit. For example, just from the small things like "In God We Trust" being on our coins.
And the pledge that we say every day as children.
You know, trying to justify all these laws out there through foundation of Christianity, especially in a country where not everyone is Christian. Abortion is just one of those pivotal examples. Or, you know, having your employers trying to say that we won't cover birth control in your health insurance. Just these very, very sexist notions that they're trying to justify with religion.
Right. And I think that's a great point, you know, for women's issues as well and feminism, because those are things that should be paramount to every woman and should be important. And regardless of what the decision is for, against any of those things, like, that is not for me to say for anyone else.
Right.
However, in my personal belief, it is not for a man to get to say for us. And it is not for him to get to decide if we carry a baby to term that we did not want, or that we were raped and that was the outcome. I am a firm believer in that women's reproductive rights, women's health, those things should get to be decided by women, because we're the ones who do it. Just like my OBGYN is a female, because she understands, you know, the things that I go through and the things that I deal with. And, you know, again, everyone gets to make those decisions personally, but I think for all women, regardless of religion, regardless of culture, regardless of the color of their skin, they should be allowed to have that representation and, you know, someone who actually understands what that means. I know that's not true in a lot of places, even here, most of the time. And so I think that that is, I think it's a really important thing that you brought up.
You know, when you look at the Islamic world and you come to the conclusion that that society is very patriarchal and women's rights don't exist there, when that's not even true for the most part, you have to take it country by country and you have to parse out the fact that it could be a culture thing and not a religion thing.
Right.
Look at Turkey example or the United Arab Emirates. It's very different in those countries. And but then you're failing to admit your own shortcomings in terms of the patriarchy that's being enforced over here in terms of, you know, the legality of things. Like the pink tax is just one small thing, right?
Right.
Something so minimal like that. Like the fact that majority of health insurers will cover Viagra, but they won't cover birth control. That in and of itself, who do you think made those laws?
It wasn't us.
Old white dudes. A lot of Muslim countries already have had a Muslim leader. Bangladesh, they had a prime minister who was Muslim, who was a Muslim woman. Benazir Bhutto, she was a leader in Pakistan. There's so many countries out there that have already had Muslim women leaders. But here we are claiming to be the most secular country on earth. But forget the presidency. Like, every leadership position is very well male dominated. It's like that in almost every country. Don't get me wrong. But the point here I'm trying to make is that we simply cannot look at the governments and the cultures of other countries and think that we're somehow better than them.
Exactly. And I think that is a huge point as well, is, you know, oh, those poor women in the East, like, I just don't know how they do it. There's something I think about a lot. Like, the thing that bothers us the most in someone else is the thing that we see in ourselves. I don't think that that's always actively recognized and, you know, that you understand it at the time. But I think that is very true in this case, right? Like, you see repressed people and you see repression and women especially. And it's like, oh, but I can save you. And the kind of this white savior narrative, like, no, that's not what is needed. And that's not what is a part or should be a part of this conversation. It's, who are you? What are you excited about? What are you passionate about? Like, are there ways for you to get that in your world, you know, in your society, in your community, wherever that may be? And how do we just empower one another to be able to do those things more? I don't know the answer. I do feel really inspired by a lot of the potential for women and for young women, and just having these conversations and having outlets and platforms to be able to let these ideas exist and really build from that. And then what does that look like as it changes over time? And how do we have these open cultural conversations, religious conversations, the hard ones? I mean, we've talked about a lot of really difficult things today, but be able to do that civilly.
Right. I completely agree. And I think you're a good prime example of that. You know, you are a white girl who grew up in a small town in Texas who had no exposure to Muslims, right?
Exactly.
And here you are, not having asked anyone where to find this information.
Exactly.
You just decided to listen to a podcast about Muslim women's issues.
Right.
Now the world is so globalized. You have information at your fingertips. And I get it. Sometimes there's a lot of false information out there and it can be hard to parse out. Totally a challenge for everyone. And that's something that we're afraid of too, in trying to combat that.
Yeah.
But if you're someone who lacks diversity in your life or has for a majority of your life, I would say that having a Muslim friend is not enough because they're not going to tell you everything. And that's one perspective.
Right.
You can't just like rely on that one token Muslim friend that you have or just like, you know, going to one Ramadan iftar.
Right.
Kind of means that, hey, you may have to sit down and do some research.
And you may get to, you know, and to the listeners, like this is something that if you do feel this, right, like this, either if it's one, a curiosity, or two, if it's I don't know enough and, you know, I just want to be more informed, there are amazing resources, obviously like this podcast, which you've already found. But there's so many resources, right? Like there's so many places to learn and to be expose yourself to cultures and to the vast numbers, to the statistics of these different cultures around the world. So many avenues to really hear different perspectives, whether it's books or audiobooks or podcasts. Just start to get curious about those things, you know, and then ask the questions when you can. Ask someone like me or someone else who may have experience. Ask someone who has lived that experience. All women are experiencing their own lived experience, whatever it looks like. Being able to just ask those questions and learn something different than what you deal with every day, I think is really, really important. It also shows kind of this shared almost solidarity in the thing that go on and, you know, these patriarchal structures, all of those things, and that we really aren't as different as we try to believe.
Right. Trying to understand that, like, everything I learned about Christianity so far was handed to me on a plate, right? I didn't have to go out venturing for it. So right. It was handed to me on a plate in my social studies class in third grade, in my history class in seventh grade. That's the goal for other cultures as well. Where it's like we make it part of the curriculum and make it part of the learning process as children are growing up, where the baseline is handed to them on the plate and then they excel beyond that on their own. And it's kind of unfair because people could argue, I didn't learn it, I wasn't taught to it, all of these things. And then, or they'll say, I didn't have like a Muslim friend. The reason that argument is so arbitrary is because, you know, you've been listening in on our family conversations in terms of the Muslim world. The Muslim family, we refer to them as the Ummah, like we're one big giant family. So you've been listening in on our conversation and even you have learned that there is differences and conflicts within our own community and differences in opinion, right? So you having maybe 5 Muslim friends is not enough because you won't learn, like those are very 5 minimal perspective. You won't learn that by having 5 Sunni friends. You won't learn that by having 1 Shia friend who's Muslim and 1 Sunni friend who's Muslim. I mean, I get it. These are different denominations of the religion, but even within the same denomination and the same school of thought, do you find differences in opinion and differences in practice? And even if it's someone from the same culture, you're going to find differences because diversity exists on not across spectrums, but within the same spectrum as well.
Yeah, I mean, we're all individuals and that is a really, really vital, important thing, like to be able to see that just like any culture, right? Not one person is the same. Not all white people are the same. We understand that, right? Like white in itself has so many different meanings, so many different lineages and where that stems from, whatever, you know, whatever it's defined as, we are all individual. And so being able to understand, especially as women, right? Like the differences and the things that go on and to diversify that as much as possible, to have conversations, to listen to podcasts, to find, and I think one great opportunity is having more people in media, and I consider this media as well, right? Like online media that can offer different perspectives and bring those different perspectives to you without you having to do much work, right? Like, no, it's not necessarily in the curriculum yet, but that would be an amazing thing in the future and something that I would love to work towards. And also, they're out here now, right? Like if a kid gets curious or if you as an adult at whatever age get curious about these things, there are resources out there. And so just seek them out and find ways to have these conversations, sure, even if they maybe feel a little uncomfortable at first.
Okay, so that wraps up our conversation for today. It was very interesting. Thank you so much for being on, Carly. Carly Deerdorf. So thank you for listening to our podcast, Think Like a Lady. Just to recap, we are a podcast that aims to bridge the gap between intersectional feminism and Muslim women. Next episode, Dua will be on.
We're going to be talking about children born out of wedlock, particularly in terms of Muslim society and the Islamic implications of that, and how often a woman is ostracized while a man kind of gets away with it, and what that means for the child growing up.
So I guess we'll see you guys next time. It was so lovely of you guys to be listening to us. Okay, bye guys.
Bye.
Assalamu alaikum.
I love the way it sounds. And then I always, I'm like, no, don't say it, you white person, because you say it wrong and it doesn't sound good.
Say it. I want to hear you.
Just say bye like a little white girl.
No, say it. I want to hear you.
You say it. You say it first and then I'll parrot
it. Assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum.
See, that was good. You said it good. Okay, try saying wa alaikum assalam.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Oh my God, can I use that?
Yeah, you can, for sure.